Well, thank you all for being here. I realize I'm standing between you and the reception, which is always a challenge. How many of you know who NIEHS is? It's actually more than I thought. You know that we are kind of the odd duck in the NIH firmament. We are the only institute or center that is not in Bethesda. We are the only institute or center that has a focus on public health rather than medicine. And I think we are really one of the only institutes that has a major focus on the opportunity to prevent. Because I even have my boss, Francis Collins, saying, you can't change your genes, but you can change your environment. So what I'd like to tell you a little about today is the strategic planning that we've been undergoing for the last year or so, which is now just about complete. Our strategic plan is up on our website, and I would urge you to take a look at it because I think there's a big change in our strategic plan from 2012 to 2017 from the previous one, which had been developed under the previous NIEHS director, which had many good things about it, but never mentioned public health and never mentioned prevention as part of it. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about how we developed the strategic plan because we used a very different model than, again, is frequently used. I didn't go into my office, close the door, and start writing. I said that in order to look at issues of environmental health sciences, we need to involve the community in telling us what they think is important in environmental health sciences. This is a little bit like the need for community-based participatory research, where you don't tell people what you think they want to know, but you get them involved from the very beginning about, in fact, what you want to know. So we had a three-phase process, which started out with asking the community via web-based information, what do you think is important? What are your visionary ideas? And we got over 10,000 hits, and I'm going to show you that in a minute. We held a series of stakeholder and community workshops, and then we got busy developing the goals and are currently working on implementation. So we received over 231 visionary ideas. Many of them got comments. I should mention that everything went up anonymously, so no one could worry about what someone said or could really trace ideas to any one person. We had over 3,000 people looking at this website all the time, and then people got to vote on these 231 ideas, which were really enriched by the comments that were received. And then we actually kind of collapsed all of these different ideas into categories and put that online. And kind of the little diagram at the bottom are just some of the words that just kept coming up again and again and again. So then we held a stakeholder community workshop almost a year ago, and we had over 170 participants doing something called open space meeting. And if none of you have ever done it, and somebody tells you about it, and you're skeptical, all I can say is it's great. It really works. But believe me, I don't know how many of you have ever been to a friend's meeting. But, okay, if you go into a friend's meeting, you don't say anything until someone is moved. And I was afraid that was going to happen in our open space meeting, because you sit around in a circle, and I kind of talked to the people at the very beginning and talked a little about what we were looking for. I reminded everybody to take off whatever hat they were wearing at the time, because we were not looking for someone's personal, individual focus of their ideas, but the bigger issues of what are the key issues that we need to be investing in environmental health sciences research. And that's why I wear the sombrero. That was the first of about seven hats I put on to make the point. And then our facilitator kind of gave us a charge. And frankly, I was absolutely sure that we were going to sit in total silence for 20 minutes, at least, at which point the facilitator had told me, now don't worry, because if it goes 20 minutes, I'll stand up and start something. Well, by the time she finished, we had 90 people in line, ready to write their visionary idea down on a big piece of paper and post it on the walls, like just around here. We ended up with 127, I believe, different ideas coming up from this, which we could kind of collapse into these different kind of basic themes. We actually ended up with 13, which then collapsed even further. Basic research on human health and disease, exposure science and the exposome, translational science, collaborative and integrative approaches for conducting research, data management and analysis, global environmental health and health disparities, training of the workforce, and communication and outreach. So this was followed. So those themes were a result, really, of the visionary ideas on the website, as well as this stakeholder process that we held. So then we held another stakeholder institute workshop, kind of a mixed, with about 50 or 60 people in October. And the objective of this workshop was to take all the work which had already been done, draft a mission and a vision statement, and supporting themes for it, and then try to elaborate and clarify these themes. And these are the missions and visions that NIEHS has adopted, that our mission is to discover how the environment affects people in order to promote healthier lives, and our vision is to provide global leadership for innovative research that improves public health by preventing disability and disease from our environment. So we've got prevention and we've got public health right up there in, I should say, bright letters. This is, I call this my cloud diagram. These are the themes that we ended up with. And what this is supposed to convey is that you can't do, for example, translational research, which we define not as just bench to bedside, but as bench to public health, and often that has to go through policy. And, of course, sometimes it goes back and forth as well. But you can't do the translational science unless you know what exposures you're concerned about. And frequently you need to know what's the basic science underlying it. And then you better be sure that you're working with communities who have concerns, and those are often our disadvantaged communities. And then you better try to educate the next generation or the people in what you're trying to do, and then you've got to communicate everything that you do. And you can't do any of these things unless you take a multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary kind of approach, get people working together, often who have not worked together before, and then you've got to manage not only the data, but the knowledge. So a little bit, I think a little bit of what you were saying, Shariki, it's qualitative times, it's not always quantitative that we're going to have to be managing. So in order to develop the strategic goals based upon all the work that had gone on and the themes that were developed, we pulled together our leadership team. My leadership team's my different division directors, to spearhead the process. In each division, I have a division of intramural research, like any NIH Institute. I have a division of extramural research, like any institute. I also have a division of the National Toxicology Program, which is a cross-HHS effort whose mission is not basic biomedical research, but is actually solving problems related to toxic exposures or adverse kinds of exposures. We also have our Office of Management, where the people who are the ones who facilitate everything that we do, and then we have also have the greater office of the director and the deputy director. So all of these different groups held their own strategic planning sessions to try to develop the goals that would facilitate our being able to achieve the mission and vision that we had set. We coalesced them into a single list and ended up with 11 institutional goals. And if you want to know why 11 and not 10 and 12, I often joke it's because my husband's a mathematician and he really likes prime numbers better than anything else. So when we talk about the strategic goals, I'm just going to very, very briefly go through them. I want to, again, all of this is now available on the web. We're in the final processes of putting all the pretty pictures that will actually go into what the final version will be, but all the meat is available right now on our website. So this is the basic, as we often call, the basic science goal, the basic research to identify and understand fundamental shared mechanisms or common pathways underlying a broad range of complex diseases to enable the development of prevention and intervention strategies, okay? Not just treatment and cures. We want to be able to prevent adverse effects. So we're looking at things related to genomics and epigenomics, understanding the protective mechanisms that occur, understanding normal processes of human development, and identifying environmental factors that can contribute to altered function, and to try to integrate high-throughput screening, cell systems, and model organisms to identify fundamental mechanisms. I'm sure you've all heard the comments that there are 80,000 chemicals in commerce, and we know next to nothing about the great majority of them. We've got to develop a better way of screening chemicals for adverse effects before actually we have them in our marketplace. The second goal is looking at the issue of individual susceptibility across the lifespan. What is happening not only in our country, not only in Europe, what is happening in the developing world as well? The biggest causes of morbidity and mortality are chronic non-communicable diseases. And we need to begin to understand that the environment, broadly defined, can play a role. And we need to do this by looking at basic and population-based studies in order to prevent and decrease the public health burden of diseases. So we're really focusing on what are those critical windows of susceptibility. I mean, I think we all know that in utero is a critical window. But how many of us think about puberty as necessarily being a critical time, or pregnancy as being a critical time, critical window that can have long-lasting effects? We need to have a better understanding of what those kind of exposure-response relationships may be different during parts of the lifespan. And we have to understand what makes, for example, George is susceptible to some environmental exposure, and I'm not susceptible, or maybe I'm less susceptible. So we need to understand what are those factors, and they may vary depending where you are in your life. The third goal is to work on this whole issue of transforming exposure science. You know, we tend to look at exposure as one chemical at a time, or maybe one exposure at a time. In tobacco, the example, I think we, you know, focusing on tobacco, but not thinking about, well, what about the Doritos that's next to the cigarettes? I mean, we have to start developing more integrated approaches, and we have to link them to the biological pathways. So we're looking at better methods for improved exposure assessment, not only at the individual level, but at the population level. We have to, we're very excited about the concept of the exposome. And you've all heard about the genome and the proteome and the metabolome and the lipidome. I think it's lipidome. Yeah, lipid. Okay. Well, the exposome is the totality of exposure that you know, and looking at it in an agnostic way, not going in and saying, I'm going to measure 250 chemicals that are present in your body, but saying, what's the totality of what's there? And those approaches are starting to be developed. And then we want to create tools and technologies and the capacity to characterize the exposome. So our fourth goal is to look about how combines, again, this issue of combinations of exposures affect disease pathogenesis, looking at the joint action of multiple environmental insults. And the point I'm making here is our institute has largely focused before on issues of chemical exposures, environmental chemicals. That's still a focus for us, but you're not exposed to environmental chemicals in a vacuum. You know, you're also exposed to what you ate today, and we now know there's growing evidence that eating a high-fat diet completely alters how you respond to, say, environmental chemicals. And we know, for example, that exposure to environmental chemicals completely may alter your response to influenza virus, and potentially vice versa. And we all are very excited about what's being reported more and more about the microbiome, which are the bugs that live in and on us in multiple places. And we are beginning to understand that those are very important in our health, and we need to understand the relationships of how different environmental exposures may alter the microbiome or vice versa. So we're having to look again at the interaction of different kinds of environmental insults in order to allow us all to lead healthy lives. The fifth one is actually an interesting one, which is we have to be able to respond to emerging environmental threats, both on a local and global scale. We have to look at our researches to deal with timely and effective public health action. And some of you may know that we stepped in immediately upon the Deepwater Horizon Gulf oil spill in April 2 years ago, and have mounted a very large, multifaceted research program, at least a 10-year research program, looking at the health of people who were involved in the cleanup, looking at the health of families women and children who are living in the Gulf region, looking at issues of resiliency, looking at issues of mental health and psychological stress in these populations, looking at issues about what are the ongoing exposures that people face. I mean, and I'm talking here about a close to $100 million 10-year effort that we've launched to respond to an immediate public health issue. We also have to work with other partners to provide appropriate responses when we have emerging environmental threats, and then we have to focus on the research needs to help inform policy responses. And I think this is really very important. I mean, I know that in our state of North Carolina, you know, our legislature has recently outlawed using science when to deal with issues of climate change. You know, there isn't, you know, the beaches aren't going to shrink because the legislature has said so. But anyway. So the strategic goal number six is looking at establishing an environmental health disparities research agenda to understand the disproportionate risks of disease and define and support public health and prevention solutions in affected populations. Again, as I think we all agree, you cannot do this type of work without doing community-based participatory research. We're focusing on some of the issues of research and education on ethical, legal, and social implications of our research. You know, it's one thing to have all the data about your genome posted on the web. You know, it's easy to anonymize that information. It's not so easy to anonymize the environmental information about where you live and have someone be unable to identify you when you try to anonymize it. And we need to develop and recommend or implement interventions to reduce or eliminate environmental exposures that cause the greatest burden of disease to affected populations. Again, prevention. Our seventh goal is the knowledge management approach, the techniques to create a collaborative environment for our community to encourage an interdisciplinary approach. We need to do more in the development of bioinformatics, biostatistics, and data integration tools, and we need to develop and invest in publicly available resources and computational tools as a key issue for the environmental health sciences community. This is the issue of teaching and training. You know, part of the reason that the North Carolina legislature can pass a law that say climate change can't happen because we say so is because of a failure of science education at all levels. And so that we are completely committed to increasing the scientific literacy from kindergartens up to the professional level. We need to empower individuals at all levels of education with knowledge. I mean, knowledge is power, so that they can make better health decisions. We're going to strengthen the environmental health science education and literacy. We are focusing on the development of critical training programs in environmental health sciences for different groups, ranging from students to science teachers. And we need to work to incorporate environmental health sciences into medical education practice, all facets of medical education and practice. I mean, I can tell you, I mean, I've got a son and daughter-in-law who are both physicians, and when I asked them how much environmental health science did you have in your medical school, I think they said 1 hour. And they're both primary care docs doing public health work, I should say. So not really very helpful. We need to do a better job of incorporating it. Our ninth goal is kind of inspirational, but we need to develop and train a cadre of scientists to move this transformative environmental health science forward, training the next generation of environmental health science leaders from a broad range of scientific disciplines and diverse backgrounds. You don't have to come into this field being specifically having been trained in environmental health. You can move in and achieve your training. So the need for cross-disciplinary training, recruitment of trainees from other disciplines, creating opportunities throughout people's careers. It doesn't just have to be in training, say, at the graduate level or at the postdoctoral level. We need to integrate the environmental health sciences into medical education. We need to help build environmental health capacity in countries around the world that are experiencing the greatest problems from environmental health. And we have to increase the diversity within our training programs for environmental health scientists. The 10th goal is a really new one for us. And part of this is based upon the current political environment, that where people want to know, well, show me the money. What is the benefit of what you're going to do? So we need to evaluate the economic impact of policies, practices, and behaviors that reduce exposure to environmental toxicants, leading to prevention of disease and disabilities, and invest in research programs to test how prevention improves public health and minimizes economic burden. So we're developing an interdisciplinary research and training program in environmental health economics. We're measuring the economic benefits and comparative effectiveness of our investments, and we're trying to work with policymakers with systematic reviews and state-of-the-science assessments to help make clinical and policy recommendations. And our last strategic goal is to focus on bidirectional communication and collaboration between the researchers and the stakeholders, whether the stakeholders are the policymakers or the clinicians or the intervention prevention practitioners and the public, to advance research, translation, and the environmental health sciences. We're trying to make ourselves seen as the trusted and accessible source of environmental health sciences information. We're trying to identify and expand our stakeholder communities. We're building and enriching long-term federal and non-federal partnerships with health education agencies and stakeholder groups. We are conducting research when we need to on how do we communicate information about environmental health sciences. And we're developing an integrated, searchable knowledge base on the impact of the environment and human health. So we are currently about halfway through our implementation strategies, how we're going to accomplish these 11 goals. And one thing I didn't mention, actually, is our mission and vision is not that we are going to do everything that is in our goals. We are going to provide some leadership and encourage others in the community and in the world to get involved in addressing some of these goals. So our implementation strategies is our internal blueprint of what will we do, when will we do it, and how much is it going to cost. We're currently developing these. I have draft plans from all my divisions. We're kind of beginning to look at it because there's a great deal of cross-divisional effort. My vision for an NIEHS is one NIEHS, which does not mean that my extramural grantees are going to be doing exactly what my intramural scientist is, but it means when appropriate there'll be opportunities for them to share information, to collaborate, to work together. And again, the implementation strategies will provide a framework for budget allocations by leadership. So the commitment of NIEHS is translating bench science into environmental public health. I just wanted to, I think many of you may have seen this paper that appeared a few months ago in Environmental Health Perspectives, which is our institute's journal. This is from David Bellinger at Harvard, where he was making the point. He was basically counting the number of IQ points that are believed across a population of children that are associated, for example, with the medical conditions, the risk factors that we think of, such as congenital heart disease or preterm birth or type 1 diabetes. And he was contrasting them or looking at, well, how many IQ points are lost in the population, for example, for exposure to the only three environmental chemicals that there was enough data for him to make those calculations, and that was lead, methylmercury, and organophosphate pesticides. And what you can see is that the number of points lost across the population is as great or greater than for many of the traditional medical factors. And this is the whole issue, is that we need to think, I'm kind of bringing coals to Newcastle, we need to look at the public health impact, not only the individual impact. So there's a new version for NIEHS and the National Toxicology Program, a strong desire to partner with our sister institutes and other feds, that healthy in the environment is our priority. We have new issues and technologies. We need both the best individual and the team science to address complex diseases and complex environmental impacts. We need to improve the integration across research disciplines and with all our partners. And we must improve our translation and communication of basic science findings into human health protection. So thanks to everybody.
Well, thank all three of you. We've got about 25 minutes to really do some Q&A, and you can line up and ask questions. I'm going to start by just pointing out that, we've had three different perspectives, but I think one of the unifying things around this is all three of our speakers talked about really the complexity of looking at the evidence to make public health decisions. From this is an amazing presentation on environment, and I just think about all the things that in the environment that could affect you, and how do you put that together? I mean, as a health official, I was always struck when I would get these calls about small area analysis, because, you know, four people in a community got cancer, and, you know, the traditional small area cancer cluster, and the real difficulty we had in trying to figure out, you know, what the impact was, what the exposure was, and what it really would mean. And we always usually ended up scratching our heads at the end of this, because we quite often couldn't give the community an answer you know, this amazing GIS demonstration of how you can use data in a very very complex data in a very practical way. You know, and I have these visions now of running into legislators' offices. I used to run in with data showing them health disparities and pretty simple data, but now going with graphs showing them truly where the kids are smoking and you know, in essence, who's responsible for those kids smoking. To Shriki's very eloquent description on the methodology and hopefully giving us a perspective on how to approach these so that, you know, we recognize there is an evidence base. We just need to pull it together and articulate it. So all three of our speakers have shown us that there's a very complex way for us to think about these things, and we ought to be bringing the evidence, you know, base together to try to do that. And again, so I think the final thing Linda again pointed out, we do always have to show the return on investment in this current political environment. Gail.
And they were willing and went to the door-to-door knocking on doors to identify people who had had cancers in households. As a researcher, I can poke holes in all the reasons why, because small numbers, rural communities, people went away to work, they came back to die, all kinds of problems. But bottom line, we went to a community that could observe and document that for years during the 50s, of all these things, they had no mosquitoes. They didn't have a lot of other things flying in the air. There was an environmental Rachel Carson kind of impact that we know has to have some kind of impact on people's health. The kinds of evidence, Shriki, that you were talking about, how do communities come and say, work with us so that we can make a case to the powers that be that our health suffer. What kinds of evidence, what kinds of guidance, how does NIDHS, how do you work with